Blog Talk Radio.
The streets don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your host, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back.
Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today is March 23rd, 2011. I'm your host, with my co-host Boyd, and our topic is, as always, the Streets Don't Love You Back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes as we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight. We have Ms. Monica Day. Monica has an extensive story. She was raped at a convention, at a church convention by age 11. She was a teenage runaway, made some bad choices, ended up in the correctional facility for a couple of years, got into a couple of abusive relationships. And then tonight we're going to hear her story and how she was able to overcome all of that and how she survived those situations and what she's doing now to help others to be able to get through all of that and to have a healthy and happy life. So Rob will be joining us here in just a little bit, and let me go ahead and welcome Monica to the show.
Thank you, Lucinda. Peace and blessings to all the listeners tonight.
And Rob just joined us. Welcome, Rob, to the show.
Hi, Rob. Yeah, I would just like to thank everybody for tuning in tonight. Unfortunately, I've been just a tad bit late. My father passed, and been at the funeral and meeting up with my sisters and brothers who I've never met before. You know, today was a real, real blessed day. I met one of my brothers that's 50 years old, never met him. Met my baby sister that's 30 years old, and met another one of my sisters that's the same age I am. So it's been a real blessing and a real pleasure, you know, to meet them at a time of this right here. And I just thank my wife for being such a great comrade and a great wife and a great person standing by me through all this and through everything that goes on with me. So I just want to give a shout-out to my wife as well.
Hey, that's what families are for, stick together. And, you know, I just, I'm glad you're having a good time with your family today and, you know, meeting your brothers and sisters. It's got to be an awesome feeling to know that, I mean, you always knew somebody was out there, but now you're, you know, able to meet them, and I think that's just awesome.
Right, yeah, and they all very intelligent people, and they all professional people, and that just really blew me away, you know, to... you know, meet all of them, and they have a lot going on in their life, and we basically all do a lot of the same things, you know, and I was just a tremendous, like, wow, you know, they said, oh, I do that too. I'm like, oh, okay, I do that too. So, you know, we were just sitting
awesome.
Here going back and forth, like, oh, I do that too, you know, so it was just a real awesome feeling today, and out of my father's 12 kids, you know, I had a pleasure, it was six of us here, you know, and six of us not here today who I still never met, and that was six other brothers of mine, you know, it was all together, it's nine boys and three girls, you know, so it was just a blessing to meet them, and one of my baby sisters is in ministry, you know, so that really blew me away, you know, and she
any
does
doubt,
a lot.
Though. I mean, that's what your dad did, so...
Right,
you know?
And she does a lot of things. She do a lot of speaking engagements. She's been in ministry over 10 years, and she's just 30 years old.
Awesome.
She has no children, and she's an executive. So it's just real deep on how my father's ties go and how that DNA is real heavy among his kids. And we all doing something real positive, so it's just awesome, you know?
That's awesome. Well, I already introduced Monica to the show, and, you know, we just want to send out our condolences to the entire Boyd family again. And
absolutely.
you know, glad that Dad's now resting at peace, and grateful that you know, you're connecting with your family. I just think that's so great.
Yeah, and we took a lot of pictures. Just want to tell all the listeners, we took a lot of pictures today, and I would like for everybody to, when you get time, log on to our movement site, and special thanks to my wife for putting up in memory page for my father. So you can log on to www.thestreetsdontloveyouback.neen.com and look up under my father's name, Reverend Robert D. Boyd Sr., and you will see a lot of history of my father. My father was an author of 66 books around the world, which I'll be releasing some of his books as well. And you'll see a lot of pictures and different things of my family and my father's history. So, you know, God is good, and I'm just glad, you know, that I'm here to carry his name on. So just want to say that, and I will be calling back into the show in the next 15, 20 minutes. I'm on my way to my place where I can really sit down and get on the show, and I'm going to wrap it up with, you know, my loved ones here. And I'll be calling back in about 15 or 20 minutes. And I just want to thank everybody for their love and their prayers and all the things that they do to not only help themselves but help others as well.
That's right. Okay, well, enjoy the last little while with your family, and we'll pick you back up here in just a little bit.
All right, then. Much love to everybody. And I wanted to say I love you, and I'll talk to you real shortly, sweet.
Okay. Love you too, baby.
All right.
Aww.
Good night, everybody.
Okay. My sweetheart.
How beautiful. How beautiful.
I love
it.
He's my heart.
Now, okay. That's an inspiring story.
Yeah, we have a pretty inspiring story. We'll have to call that out one night, but
right.
But tonight's your night, so we're gonna talk with Monica tonight. We're gonna have Monica, you know, let's go back to your childhood and start at the beginning. You know, how did you grow up? Did you have both parents? Were you, you know, in foster care? I mean, just let us know a little bit about your family history, where you come from, and we know that even people that come from good families get raped and abused. So that's not even, you know, the question, but just let us know how you grew up, what was going on in your life, and then, you know, what led to the, you know, to being raped at age 11, and just let us know your story.
Absolutely. Well, I did grow up with both parents. I was born and raised in Durham, North Carolina, which is where I currently reside now, and grew up with both parents, came up in a Christian environment. As far back as I can remember, we went to church all the time. Every time the doors was open, we went to church. So I really grew up in church with a spiritual background and Christian background. And went to school. I really had no big problems. I'm a daddy's girl, really close to my father, even to this day. I have one sister and four brothers. So I pretty much was next to the youngest. My sister is about 10 years older than me, and so I really didn't have that sister energy in the house. Mom stayed in church a lot, and that's kind of our bond and how we connected. So my relationship with my parents really was more so I was closer to my father and growing up with my brother. So grew up, went to school, didn't have any issues growing up, behavior issues growing up in school, pretty much a AB student. Elementary, middle school, until my life changed, I guess, pretty much after the rape. I attended a church convention in July of 1992, and a big church convention they have every year in downtown Durham. And after being in the church service for a little bit, I went out to the restroom where there's a lot of different vendors from different places selling different things. And as a result, there's a lot of people really busy out there. And I was pretty much manipulated and grabbed and taken on the elevator to a fourth floor where this gentleman Probably he was probably 17 years old is what he looked like to me, not very old. Took my childhood is what I say. You know, he told me to do what he asked me to do, and I wouldn't get hurt. And he took me to an open stairwell, and he raped me. And what only lasted maybe 10, 15 minutes was a lifetime for me.
Right.
He took my childhood away from me. I was 11 years old about that time, and it changed my life. It changed my life completely. After he sexually assaulted me, he got up, and I never saw him again, neither did anyone else. I was disoriented for a little bit, went downstairs, and immediately it seemed like I ran into my mom. I guess I'd been gone a long enough time that she started looking for me, and I couldn't really talk. Don't really remember a lot of the events that happened. I do remember going to the hospital, asking what happened. They did the rape kit. And, you know, I gave them the description of the gentleman, but it was the last day of the church conference. And a lot of the vendors, of course, are packing up and going back to their homes. And they never found the guy. Yeah, they never found the guy. I think they got really close, but they never found him, and there were no charges held against him. And so that day just totally changed my life. I shut down. Parents, of course, you know, there was therapy involved, but when they sent me to a counselor, there was a male counselor, and I wasn't even trying to talk to him. So I really shut down. Counseling didn't help. I didn't really feel like I had anyone to talk to, really didn't know how to articulate what I was feeling. So being very, you know, silent and mute for about a year or so until all of those things, emotions that I held in, came out in anger. I started getting in trouble in school. I started cursing teachers out, getting suspended, being very rebellious, and just began to just act out, you know, getting involved with older friends, you know, people that are 4 or 5 years older than me, both male and female, and getting attention from older guys. At 12 years old, I looked like I was 16 or 17, if not older, and I took advantage of that because I was hurting. I tell people a lot of times that there are oftentimes two things happen to a victim that's been violated, and it's either they shut down and they don't want to deal with sex at all, or they become very promiscuous. And I was the young girl who, after a year of shutting down, became very promiscuous. I was searching for some type of void, and I, whether it was love or whether it was attention or whatever it was, and I associated that with sex. And getting involved with older guys, hanging out with the wrong crowd, I found myself in my first abusive relationship. Not knowing what that was at that time, but I found myself with a guy who was very possessive at about 12, 13 years old after running away from home. I didn't understand what domestic violence was at that time. No, you know, nobody in my surroundings was talking about domestic violence, you know. And so I was in this relationship with this guy. He was about 17 or 18 years old, and from the very beginning, he was controlling. He would always want my time. He would, you know, pretty much rape me too, multiple times, you know, and make me have sex with his friends and, you know, laugh about it, you know, and just a lot of different, and beat me in front of his friends. And at 13 years old, I was too afraid to, you know, go home and tell my dad or tell my brothers or tell anybody what was going on, because this guy was a drug dealer. He had guns. He was really a street guy. So I was afraid that if I told my dad, being a daddy's girl, you know, dad is going to try to protect his daughter because that's what fathers do. You know, I was afraid of what could happen. You know, this guy hurt my father, with my father hurt him, get in trouble, you know, just whatever. And so I dealt with it. hung out with him, just continued to run away from home. And eventually my father, you know, found out. And what's so sad about it is that my dad was trying to, watching his daughter pretty much be rebellious, getting in a lot of trouble. He was seeking help. He was going to, you know, different, out in the community, going to counselors and different people, just trying to get help for his child because he saw me going down the wrong path. You know, I would leave home in the middle of the night, leave the door wide open, didn't care if anybody broke in or any of that. And I was just out of control. And my father was seeking help, trying to go out, trying to get help for me, you know. And everybody was tell him that, well, you know, until she gets in trouble with the law, there's nothing we can do, you know. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't too much longer that that's pretty much what happened. I got in trouble my first year in high school. I got in trouble with the law and started a fight, set up a fight. And pretty much what was just supposed to be a real simple fight, you know, some girls was starting stuff, and I hooked up a few of my friends, said, we're going to go jump on this girl. What was supposed to be just a real simple fight, it ended up being that the girl was left for dead. And the crazy part about it is that I went from pretty much being the victim to being an abuser. By this time, I'm 14 years old when I got in trouble, and I remember that day being out and jumping on this girl in, like, this wooded area. And I just remember some of the things that the guy who had abused me had said to me. You know, he called me a whore. He called me, you know, all types of names, and he would tell me he would kill me, he would kill my family, all that. And those things were the things I said to this young lady as I was out here fighting this young girl, this girl I went to school with. So I went from so easily out of being the victim, hurting, to taking my hurt and my pain out on someone else. And, you know, we tortured her for hours out there. And four girls, out of the four girls, you know, the cops came and you know, they went to each person's house and got the story. And by the time they got to my house, they said, everybody said, you're the ringleader, Monica, and we're going to lock you up. So out of all four girls, you know, I was pretty much the only one that was sent away. Took the bulk of the crime. I did set it up, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't supposed to be the fight that it ended up being. You know, it was really bad where we just tortured her, stripped her naked, just out in the woods, just did a lot of things that, just a lot of anger and hurt, just a bunch of kids, just things acting crazy, I guess, you know. And I know for me, it was about taking my frustrations out on somebody else because I was a hurting teen.
And all that happened to you.
Right.
And for those just joining us, Monica was raped at age 11, and they never were able to catch the abuser, and then was in an abusive relationship with her boyfriend and had been used and abused and passed around. And so here she is at age 14, and now she's lashing out her anger at someone else.
Exactly. And pretty much I was sent away for 2.5 years. When I look back on it, that was the best 2 years of my life because had that not happened at 14, I might not have changed my life. I might not have had that opportunity to be away from everything, to sit down and to think and try to get an understanding of what it was I was feeling. So I was sent away for 2.5 years out at the juvenile detention facility. I was classified as a serious offender. And basically what that means is I had to attend a group with other serious offenders as well. I was there for 2 years, and that's where a lot of my writings came into play. As a poet, poetry became a big part of my life. And when I didn't know how to express myself in words, you know, communicating with a person, I knew how to write it. I could express how I felt, how certain things that had bothered me, you know, relationships, things like that, with my mom and, you know, getting into the trouble and things like that. And so I started writing a lot while I was there. Some of the poetry in the beginning was just letters to God that came out very poetically. And then from there, I learned that when I would write, it actually made me feel better. It was a release that was happening.
Right.
And from there, I just continued to write as a coping method for me to deal with different things that I experienced. So after being there for 2 years, I finally was released, had a lot of time to think, going to these groups and things like that, and learning, you know, somewhat of my abuse was a part of why I was incarcerated and gotten into this trouble, and that getting some help for that while I was there. But it wasn't over then. I had a fresh start. I was getting out, and I got out at 16. I was almost 17 years old. And, of course, you go to school when you're in there. So I got out going into the 12th grade. So I felt like my life was starting over, you know. I have a fresh start. I had never had my freedom taken away from me. So that's always a lesson, you know, when you've never been away from family and all of a sudden you're locked up in a room. You know, you got to get up when they tell you to and eat the food they tell you to. It's crazy, you know, to be a teen in a situation like that. But I got out. Came back home and really felt like, okay, I could start my life over. And I went back to school, and in about 3 or 4 months after being out, I was back into another abusive relationship. And all I've ever known was abuse at this time. So my mindset, really, although I look back now and I say, those signs were there from the beginning. You know, I remember meeting this guy. I remember the possessiveness. I remember the jealousy. I remember the conversations in the very beginning. But all I ever knew was that control. And in my mind at 16, 17 years old, I really thought if you didn't hit me, you didn't love me. Because that was my mindset. And so when he was possessive and, you know, a little jealous, where you going, who you hanging out with, I associated that with love. Oh, he cares about me. He just cares about me. He's just worried about me. And that's how I was thinking. Mm-hmm. And I was with him. I guess the abuse, like I said, it started very early on. At 17, we pretty much got together. The possessiveness and jealousy was there in the beginning. And within a few months, we also became pregnant. I really didn't know him that well, and was still caught up in my sexual acts, being promiscuous and being open. And so here I am out thinking that things were better, and they really wasn't, because I was still hurting. And because it takes a lifetime sometimes to get over certain things, you know, that you experience traumatically.
Right. Before you go on, let me ask you a couple of questions real quick. Those 2 years while you were in juvenile and you were going through counseling and stuff, did they talk to you about love and control? And, I mean, obviously they probably did some anger management type stuff, but what... And you, I'm sure you said that you learned a lot, that you still came out and went to the same type of relationship. What do you remember about those sessions, or what do you think that maybe they should have told you different, or do you think that anything they said would have helped you or not?
They let me know that some of my frustrations and anger stem from being violated, but a lot of what those sessions that I remember was more focused around the reason I was there, which was the crime. Not so much of teaching me about love, teaching me, you know, there was anger management. I do remember some reenactments about anger and, you know, taking on the role as the victim and, you know, my counselor would play the role as me. And understanding what that felt like. So I learned, you know, or I developed the remorse for the victim, but I did not deal with my own drama and,
right.
and trauma,
I mean,
of
the
being
reason,
abused.
The, yeah, back to the reason that made you do that act in the first place was the things that happened to you in the past.
Exactly. Exactly. So I don't think I learned more about the crime and that
right.
I didn't ever want to get locked up again, you know, but
right.
the pain was still there from being violated at such a young age.
Right. Yeah. And at that point, I think, too, and a lot of girls, young teenagers, you know, they don't really know what true love is. I mean, we know what, you know, our parents' love for us, we think, or our love for our parents. But at that
mm-hmm.
age, I think we're kind of selfish anyways as young teenagers. And
mm-hmm.
and a lot of girls are looking for that love and acceptance, and they think that giving or, you know, they're trading sex for love
mm-hmm.
and thinking that that's what makes the relationship.
Right.
And that a lot of girls, you know, become promiscuous because they don't find the love that they're looking for, so they move on and they trade sex for love again. They don't find
mm-hmm.
that satisfaction or that love or that, you know, and it just goes on and on and on. And then we get low self-esteem because we feel
mm-hmm.
bad that we've done the things that we've done. And it's just a vicious cycle. Where does it end,
it,
you know?
It is. And if you don't learn true love and what love really is, and if you don't rebuild that confidence and self-esteem that's been shattered, you will continue that cycle. And it carries on into your adult life. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it does. It just becomes a vicious cycle that if you don't get the help you need, you
mm-hmm.
will just it will just continue on. I've met people
right.
in doing speaking engagements that are, you know, my grandmother's age, 70 years old, that have never dealt with a sexual abuse or violence that's happened to them in their childhood.
Right. Right.
And they're still dealing with it, you know, the
yeah.
low self-esteem and things like that.
Exactly. And we can't forget either that a lot of people get married because, you know, that same thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
you think that person loves you. But you can get, you know, raped over and over and over in your relationship with your husband or your, you know, your partner or whatever if there's not that real love and it's just a controlling type of thing. Or if there's alcohol or drugs involved.
Exactly.
And a lot of people don't talk too much about that, but it's definitely, I mean, if you don't want to have sex with somebody and they force you, it's rape.
Exactly. Yep. Yep, and that's what I experienced in the first relationship, that he would pretty much want to have sex when I didn't, or if I didn't, he would take it. And then he would go buy me, you know, a gift, you know, or something and apologize, and it was an ongoing cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't feel good about myself, and the only
right.
thing, you know, pretty much that I'm associating anything that feels good or feels like he loves me is when he's laying on top of me.
Right.
So yeah, it just carries on.
Right.
And because I didn't get, I guess, the help that I truly needed, which people didn't look at, this is what she's been through. They said it. They said, yeah, you've been through this. And, you know, we talk about it a little bit when I was incarcerated, but the main thing was really focused on the crime.
Right.
So I get out at 17. I know for sure I'm not going to get locked up again in my life.
Right.
But I'm still hurt.
Right. And, you know, that's the thing that we need to focus more on with these young kids that are getting into trouble. There's a reason that they're doing things that they're doing. They're reaching out for help, and we need to look back and find out what has gone on in their life and, you know, what can we do to help them understand, you know, things that have happened to them. Or,
mm-hmm.
you know, in your case, to be abused at such a young age is, I mean, how can we rebuild your self-esteem and let you know that you're loved and that it wasn't your fault? and that there's hope out there for you, that you're a very special person and that you are loved. And that, I mean, how do we take that out here to the streets and show these kids that? Because that's why they're out there. They're looking for love.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And a lot of times these kids, they shut down, you become isolated, and you may not get it from home. Like, you may not hear those words, I love you, or you may not get the hug or the affection that you need in the home after being violated. I know that firsthand. I can't even remember my mom really coming to me and saying, giving me that hug or talking to me or any of that. My mom was so caught up in church that she, you know, totally just brushed it off, you know. And to this day, right, you know, I've forgiven, but I just remember what I needed. I needed someone to tell me, I love you and it's not your fault. And I didn't know it wasn't my fault until I was a grown-up, you know, in my 20s. I didn't know. I didn't know it wasn't my fault. I thought I did something. I thought by me leaving out of the church, going into, you know, the bathroom to take a, you know, going to the bathroom, that it was my fault. Like, I shouldn't have, you know, been out there. I should have waited. And nobody said that. Nobody, my mom wasn't there. You know, my dad did what he could, but he was angry. You know, so I'm sure he didn't know how, but I didn't get, you know, he hugged me and he was there. And he taught me, my dad, you know, tells me, you know, always told me he loved me and has just always been, like, my best friend. But I didn't get that. And so if a child is in the home and been violated and no one ever told them you're pretty, you're beautiful, you know, just trying to help them rebuild themselves. They seek it from the streets.
Definitely. Or like we said before, trading sex for love, and you're out there, and that's just creating a monster because you're becoming to hate yourself more and more, and you're building up your anger because it's not what you really want, but you're doing it, and it just destroys you even more.
Exactly. And it led me more into, like I said, another abusive relationship, you know, where I was there in that relationship for 7 years, and out of that relationship, I have a 12-year-old daughter who is my savior. The reason that I feel like when I didn't have the strength within myself, just her existence gave me that strength to be able to leave that relationship. The first abusive relationship was a lot of physical abuse. You know, I've had black eyes, been choked till I passed out in that first relationship, a lot of physical. The second relationship that I was in, the abusive relationship, was a lot of emotional abuse, a lot of verbal abuse. It was physical too, but it was a lot of mental and emotional. And I tell people this all the time, that black eye, put a little makeup on, a little foundation, eventually that scar is going to go away. It's going to heal. It's going to go away. But when someone calls you a whore, they say you're stupid, you're dumb, you're never going to amount to anything, you're ugly, you're fat, and just degrade you and humiliate you, it's hard for you to get rid of that scar.
Right.
It's so hard. And that's what I experienced in the second relationship, which made it even worse because, as you see, you know, I've gone through a cycle of being in abuse, just being a part of abuse. Right. And I don't feel good about myself. So now I'm 17, 18. So I don't feel good about myself. You know, I know I can look in the mirror and say, oh, you know, I'm beautiful, but I don't really believe that. You know, and I don't feel good. My self-esteem is shattered. He, you know, after I had our child, of course I gained weight. And now, you know, he would just really just make me feel like I was nothing. And it was so hard to pull away because I grew up in a two-parent home. And I always said that when I have my child, I'm going to raise her in a two-parent home. That's what I knew. So I stayed through the abuse for 7 years because I didn't want my child to grow up without her father.
Right.
And she watched the abuse, you know, she saw it, and it was probably after 5 or 6 years, I just realized that I couldn't do this. She was seeing this, you know, she would get scared, you know, when even if we wasn't in a physical altercation, if we, you know, would just be having a disagreement or whatever, it scared her, and she would go and run, and she would try to get in between us. And I watched this, and I just remember one time we got in an argument, and he left, and she just saw me crying, and this she had seen several times, and this one day, you know, I say it was God speaking through her, you know, but she said, Mama, we'll be okay. You know, you don't have to stay. We'll be okay. Let him go. And I don't know what happened that day, but something happened in me that said, if I could not leave for myself, surely there was just enough strength to say, I got to leave for her because I'm her example. And if I don't teach her that it's not okay for a man, even though it's your father, it's not okay for anyone to disrespect you, to hurt you, to degrade you, any of that. If I don't teach her that, she's going to become everything that I was as a child.
Right.
And so it really gave me, at that point, it gave me the strength to say, I need to leave. Now, did I leave immediately? No. But it gave me that strength to leave and say, I have to do this. Because when you're in an abusive relationship, you can't just walk out the door and leave. You know, they're liable to kill you. They're liable to come and stalk you, hurt your family. You know, sometimes there's, you know, you have a house together, whatever. So you just can't walk away from it. You know, you have to gain that support, tell someone what you're going through and things like that so you can have that support system in place. So it took a little time.
You got to kind of step back and plan it. And just, I mean, you need to have your papers away somewhere. And you need to have your important documents. I mean, you just, little by little, you need to put things away somewhere else with someone or at another place. And it takes time to get, you know, to move out, to get your place, to figure out what you're going to do, where are you going to go, who are you going to be with, isn't it, you know. And it does take a little bit of time.
Absolutely. You know, and then, of course, just trying to build yourself up to leave. You know, I'm sure a lot of people can relate that have been in an abusive relationship. You say you're going to leave, and then he gets nice, you know. He buys you something. He apologizes. He goes to therapy. He says, oh, I'm not going to do that again. And somewhere in there, that sincere apology makes you believe him. Because, you know, ultimately, he didn't just, well, I look back now, there was jealousy and possessiveness, but a lot of time abusers don't just come out smacking you around. You know, it doesn't happen that way. They are charming, and they, you know, develop that love for this person. And so in your heart, you want them to change. You want them to be better. You want them to change. You want everything to be okay. And so you go through that cycle of saying, I'm going to leave, and then, well, we have children, and then, okay, well, maybe we can work it out. And, well, we have this house, and you're so attached to all these things that sometimes it's not that easy to walk away.
Right.
And so it took some time. It took about, from that time that she said that, it took about another year and a half or two before I was really able to walk away from it for good. We didn't live together in that 2.5 years. I went back home with my parents, you know, kind of start telling people what was going on. And my parents kind of figured it out because there were bruises. But I was able to get back into my writing because, like I said, writing has been a big part of helping me to heal and cope. And so I got into writing and writing my poetry and during this time of trying to heal, I just did a lot of writing and got away from him. And I went out, one of my girlfriends encouraged me to go to a poetry open mic and, you know, share one of your poems. And it really, that night, you know, I was kind of skeptical. I'm like, what? I don't want to, you know, this stuff is personal. You know, I don't want to share my poetry with anybody because it's my personal business. It's my real story. And
right.
I shared a poem that, this is called 3 Years. And I went to the open mic, shared it, and that night, people, women came up to me and hugged me, clapped, applauded. And me being a woman that has low self-esteem, not feeling good about myself, that those hugs and being embraced and women saying, that's my story, you inspired me, and those things, it really gave me a little bit more confidence to say, I don't ever have to go back to that again. You know,
right.
I deserve better than this. You know, and I started really right. saying those things to myself and believing it. And I didn't look back. I left, went and stayed with my parents. Of course, he was a stalker at times. He would threaten me. You know, it was a continuing cycle through that time period, even after I left him. But eventually, I was able to leave and not look back. And we also, I didn't mention this too, but during that 7 years, we actually got married. Not a big wedding, just going to the justice of the peace. We actually got married because he was from Jamaica. And I knew when I married him, I guess I must have been 22, 23 years old. I knew even then he was manipulating me. You know, he wanted to get married, mm-hmm. stay in this country, and I was a little silly young girl and just like, okay, well, maybe this will help. You know, he wants to marry,
right.
so maybe
he'll right. yeah.
change. You know, and
right.
that was my thought process. So, you know, what do? I marry him. Does he change?
Right.
No.
No.
And so, you know, I never felt like
they
I was married.
Change,
but I,
no matter how hard
no,
you try.
Exactly. They don't change because they have to get help and they have to seek
right.
that help and they have to want it. You know, and that's the
right.
thing. You know, you can't make them change. They have to want to change for themselves. So we were married after I separated from him. After the 7 years, it took a long time after that for me to get the divorce because I knew that my divorce would kick him out of the country. So I still
right.
held on. I fought through that. And it wasn't until we were separated completely, and he hasn't really taken care of his daughter, you know, because for whatever reason. But we separated. And I did not get the divorce final until 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So we were separated since I was, I don't know, since about 2004. We got mm-hmm. married, and very shortly after getting married, I realized I've made another stupid mistake and I need to leave.
Right.
And we... The divorce was not officially final until 2008. And from that, he was deported and sent back to his homeland. And so that, after holding on to that for so long, when he was being deported, even though the abuse had been long gone, you know, he wasn't here, you know, coming to my house, there was the stalking had stopped, all of those things, when that divorce became final in that courtroom that day,
mm-hmm.
I really felt like, for real, I'm free.
Right.
I don't ever have to look back. I don't have to, you know, have to worry about him or any of that. I really
right.
felt like this is done and I'm free.
Right.
The healing process is ongoing, though, you know, because after the abuse, you are rebuilding yourself. And sometimes it takes a lifetime because when healthy relationships come around, you struggle with that because the trust
right.
issues.
Or
know.
Do you recognize them when they're healthy? Because you're
exactly.
not, used to looking for a different type of person.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recognize that somebody, you know, is there that maybe really does care about you and, you're either not sure or can't recognize, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. And it's hard to recognize them when all you've ever known was something totally different, you know?
Right.
So hard to recognize what that love is. And you really can't recognize it until you learn to love yourself. And
right.
you really can't. you can't recognize that true love until you have gotten yourself away. For me, I had to get away from relationships. I had to step away from relationships, and I really had to focus on me at 25, 26 years old. I really had to focus on me and what that meant, like just really having some time for myself, really thinking through what I've been through, really evaluating how I felt about myself. And not dealing with relationships or any of that, just really focusing on me so that I could learn that I am beautiful and that I am loved and that there is someone out there that can care for me, that I can trust, that will love me for who I am. And right. It takes time because a lot of times the abuse can be gone. It can be long gone. But you can still hear those voices saying you're stupid, you're dumb, you're fat, you're a whore, you're this, mm-hmm. you know, all those negative things that right. after you hear it so much, you start believing it.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely. It takes time to heal from those damaging words that try to destroy you.
That's right. So after that relationship, what kind of counseling have you gotten to help you through that? Or did you?
Counseling has become poetry and speaking. That has been my therapy. My poetry became a big part of when I began to step out and to speak and to share my story, that became healing for me. I can't even begin to explain unless, you know, when you write, when you journal, any of that, it's therapeutic. And so through writing and sharing my story, I wrote a book while I was in the abusive relationship, I was writing the book. And the book was released in about 2004. And going out, I just continued to go out to these open mics, and my book was published in 2004, and I started sharing. From that night that I first went to the open mic, I really got inspired and wanted to continue to share because I felt empowered, and that was the first time I felt that way. So through poetry, it became my outlet. It became my outlet to deal with the depression, to deal with the anxiety, to deal with how I felt about myself, to deal with rebuilding my confidence and self-esteem, it became that. And every time I would share my story and go to a speaking engagement and share, that was healing for me. As I was working to help other people and inspire other people, it was helping me as well. Have there been any intensive counseling and things of that nature? No, and I'll tell you why. I'm not against counseling. I'm for it. But counseling for me, this is maybe because I have a major in psychology, I believe that in order for someone to really help me with the things that at this time that I had gone through, I feel like you had to walk it or you had to have an experience. So my counseling came from more so a ministry standpoint, talking to people that was more so in ministry, pastors, women in ministry and things of that nature, people that I felt comfortable talking to, that I felt like understood, more so than someone who just had a background and studied for 4 years and, you know, trying to tell me about how I feel, you know, and what I had experienced because I just have a, you know, thing with if you haven't walked this, you can read a book all day long. But if you haven't walked in these shoes, you can relate to me. But you, how can you really help if you really don't know what that's like? And so that's always been my issue, you know, with going to counseling sessions because that's what I have experienced. I have tried them a lot, you know, and the other thing is always, you know, once you go in there, it's like the first thing they do, what is it? They ready to recommend you for some medication. No. Mm-hmm. You know, I need to talk. You know, and I'm not against medication when it is, when you have such a severe severe case, but not every person needs to be medicated. You know what I mean? Some people need to find other methods of dealing with their trauma versus medication, whether that be yoga, whether that be meditation, whether that be, you know, writing, like that was my outlet, you know, writing, whatever it is, painting, different things like that, you know, that is what I feel like some people need to focus on, which is why, you know, I'm studying psychology and really interested in working with teens and people who have dealt with trauma, because I feel like I've walked through it and I have dealt with it, you know, survived, you know, and I know what a child that comes to me and says, my daddy molested me or I was raped or whatever, I know firsthand what you're experiencing. And so I feel like it's better than me just going and studying. I actually know what that's like and feel like, you know, I can definitely help.
Yeah, you know, when I was young, I was abused by, I could say, at least three people in my family. One of them was a great uncle. A couple were, you know, babysitters. I think I was probably about eight when that started, and I never told anybody. At age 13, it was like at my eighth grade graduation, I started drinking beer. So, you know, there was a party, and from then on, all through high school, I drank. And I think it was just a way for me to kind of forget everything that happened. Looking back as an adult, I had a cousin one time say, you know, you seem like an awful angry teenager. And, you know, and I never thought about that growing up, but, you know, no wonder I was, you know, I was angry, you know, but I was still looking for that attention too, you know, and in high school, I was a cheerleader. I was in, you know, tried to be in as many clubs as I could be in, you know, to do, I was a, you know, the newspaper editor. I was in journalism. I was, you know, the yearbook. I did all these things, but it was a way to, I think, try to become something better or to prove that I'm worth something. And I think a lot of kids that excel in things like that, you know, a lot of them have been abused. A lot of them probably haven't. But I think that's one way that we cope with it. We just try to, you know, do everything we can to show that we're popular and worth something. And you know, and that led, you know, to a lot of other things in my life, too. And also, I was in a 23-year relationship with a man who had been married twice before. I took on two of his kids and we got married. And I stayed with him 23 years. Most of it wasn't very good. He drank a lot. And in the beginning, I drank a lot. We went on to have four kids. And I could say the last probably 15, 20 years of our marriage wasn't that great. He drank, never came home. You know, I was waiting up all the next morning, where you been, what are you doing? And it's always, you know, an excuse. And then I went back to school and I became a registered nurse. And for those 5 years that I was in school, you know, I would hear, you know, well, you don't want to drink with me anymore. You think you're too good now. You know, a lot of verbal stuff. So are you having an affair out there, you know, because you're gone so long, or you're doing this or you're doing that? You know, I raised my kids. I went to school. I became something better because I knew that I had to take care of me and my kids. And I knew where this relationship was going. And little by little, and I kept telling them, you know, one of these days I'm not going to be here when you get home. And I told them that probably 100 or 1,000 times, right?
Right.
So finally, you know, I just, you know, my youngest was 15, 14, 15. I said, you know, I'm done. I don't need to live this way. I'm not happy. You know, nobody's happy. You know, I don't need this. And, you know, and that's what I did. Little by little, I packed all the important papers, all the pictures, my trunk was packed full of stuff in my car. And you know, then I just kind of saved up. I went and got a house. You know, I paid my utilities. I did everything. And sure enough, he didn't come home. And the next day when he did, I was packed and gone. I mean, I moved crap all night long. And he sat there going, yeah, he's like, wow. You know, and then later he said, he knows he messed up. He realized, well, of course, you know, why should I spend my whole life, you know, And I say it's an abusive relationship because he was not there a lot of times. And he lied to me about where he was. And then, you know, come home drunk and force me to have sex. You know, that's rape. You know, and that's abuse. And you know, people think, oh, you know, it's not that bad because, you know, you were married so long. You know, people live years and years and years through the crap. And
right.
I didn't, you know, I wanted my kids to have both parents. I had both parents, you know, and you know, family was very important to me. But, you know, you can just take so much. And, you know, going to school helped to empower me, realizing that I can do something great, you know,
right.
And always, always, always trying to do something better in my life to make myself, you know, I tried a lot of different home-based businesses on the side, you know, just anything because I always, even though I was working, still wanted more, wanted to have better things or, you know, become something great or, you know, but, you know, and then after that, you know, like I said, I have my own story. It is huge, but I can tell you, I've been abused. So I can, you know, I've walked a little bit in your shoes and,
Abuse comes in different forms,
definitely.
You know? And people sometimes just say, okay, well, I'm not getting physically abused. He's not hitting me, but he's calling you out your name or he's not coming home or he's lying to you, you know, the whole emotional impact, you know, and those things are a lot worse. There's financial abuse. There is, you know, where you're not allowed to work or,
right.
You know, you're not allowed to work. He gives you an allowance. Or
right.
You are allowed to work, and you have to come home and give him your check. You know, and so there's so many different forms of abuse, and some people live it, and some people are in an abusive relationship right now, and they don't even know it because they're
right.
so used to, you know, just being talked down on or being controlled or the possessiveness or whatever.
Right.
That they don't look at it as abuse because, oh, well, he's not smacking me. He's not choking me. He's not none of that. But they don't understand that verbal and emotional is just as it impacts you the same way as, if not worse, than the physical
right.
abuse.
Right. And I think a lot of times worse because it puts your, you know, it changes the way that you think and the emotions and everything that you go through. I mean, just, yeah, I mean, it's worse than I think being hit sometimes because it stays with you, you know, for so much longer and it just puts you in a state of not having that self-esteem, but just feeling bad for yourself and giving in to everything that they want and, you know, the power and control that they have over that is just, is crazy.
Right. Absolutely.
We have, Monica, we have Lisa on the line, and I'm going to pick her up right now.
Okay.
She kind of had some similar situations as well. Lisa, are you there? Lisa?
Can you hear me?
Now I can.
We ain't got Verizon over here, fool. What?
Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Wow.
Yeah, I was just telling Monica that you had gone through some abusive situations, so do you want to go ahead?
The physical... you got to bear with me. I was on two other shows tonight. And you need to be on my domestic violence show that I have on Sundays.
All right.
Okay? Yeah, because I'm tired of breast cancer.
A show that, about domestic violence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. First of all, shout out to Rob for your loss. We love you, and we're here for you. And, girl, please, you like my twin, for real. You have no idea. I'm talking about, like, the physical scars go away. Yeah, they do.
Mm-hmm.
They go away. Man, I got stab marks and everything. I got knocked out teeth. And then we lie on them.
Mm-hmm.
We lie on them. you know, because we don't want to tell nobody nothing because what goes on in the house stays in the house.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to so much, like, I spent 4 days in a coma. He kicked the baby out of my hands.
Wow.
Yeah. And I wasn't even with him. And those restraining orders are not shit. And I'll call it out. Listen to if I got to stop cussing, you better let me know.
Like I said, we keep it real.
Yeah, I keep it real. They ain't shit. They're a piece of paper. And guess what? When you were sitting in your house 10 years later, been away from him, and all of a sudden the sheriff's department shows up at your door with a restraining order against him, like, mm-hmm. he put it on me. Crackhead said, oh, let me go ahead and get some. Found out where I lived many a times. I have moved so many times. And he just continually finds out where I am. He didn't find me in Georgia. He's scared now. I'm going to tell you about that in a minute. But, yeah, me and my kid was, me and my baby girl, Princess, we was in the apartment. I just got home from work. I had a townhouse. And I will never forget this for the rest of my life. Had a townhouse. He wasn't on the lease. We was separated for how many years? Sheriff's department shows up talking about you have to leave. You got a restraining order against you. Why? He just went to the court in the county. And this motherfucker, he just really did say to them, she threatened to kill me. So the judge didn't even look at the history.
Mm-hmm.
So now I got to hand over my keys to my crib, to the police officers. I'm trying to explain to them. I'm showing them the lease and everything. He's nowhere. He don't be here. They didn't care.
Right.
So I had to go to court.
That's
7 days
crazy.
Later. The next Thursday. This was on a Thursday afternoon. The next Thursday. I had to go to court. Man, I got in that courtroom and I went off. The judge looking at me like I'm going to for contempt of court. And I'm looking at him like, if you really don't understand what you just did, signing that warrant and signing all, you know, the restraining order. He didn't care until I showed him all the paperwork I had. All the paperwork. And he just looked at me and he was like, well, I'm sorry. You're sorry? Can I get my keys back? Yes. Go ahead, back to your crib. Well, when we got there, the dog was dead. Everything in my crib was gone. Everything, including all my, anything that could be sold for money was gone. Now, let's fast forward. Then come baby girl. I'm pregnant. I find out he killed our son. I was 8 months pregnant. He kicked me in my stomach, threw me down a flight of steps. So I gave birth to my son. Yeah, I know. But so he didn't make it. But then I get pregnant with my daughter. And when I found out I was pregnant with her, Lord, I packed up the car and everything with everything I could fit, my shoes, my clothes, my pictures. That's why when I was hearing you, I was like, yo, this is my twin right here. I packed up. I packed up, sis, straight packed up. And guess where I went? I went to his ex-girlfriend's house because he would have never looked for me there. And me and her was tight. Tracy loved her to death. In North Carolina, I was in Florida at the time. Then his cousin Matt was right around the corner. And they already knew. And everybody held me down. They was like, this little girl, come on. Go get the pregnancy test. Yeah, I'm 6 weeks pregnant with the baby. Okay. He kicked me in my stomach that night before I left. So, mind you, okay, I settle in down in North Carolina, but I want to go home to Jersey. Okay. So, one of my friends decided he was going to make the trip all the way from Jersey, North Carolina, and bring me back. Got to my mother's house, God rest her soul, R.I.P. Diana, but I didn't want to stay there either. I wanted my own, so I hit my brothers in the hood from Newark. I'm a blood from the hood. So you have to understand, they took me under their wing and they taught me a whole lot in the hood because I didn't know. They got me streets. Oh, I was already brain smart. I got a master's from Princeton and 3 other degrees. But, yeah, I went to Newark. And before that, I was in Mandeville, Somerset County. And this is where I say the restraining orders are not just a piece of paper. Because 9 days after I had Maya, mommy, his mother, by the way, who don't speak to him, she brought me from, we got from the hospital, we stopped and got some formula, and went to the crib. And mommy was the only one that had keys to my apartment. Nobody, besides the landlord, of course, had keys. And I got in the house. And all of a sudden, I felt a bash behind my head. The baby got kicked out of my arms. Mm. Okay? And then I got raped and sodomized 9 days after I had the baby. And it was from her father. He found out where I was staying. And we still don't know how. But thank God, mommy had the key and realized the formula was still sitting in the back of the chair. And she came back to the crib because she only lived like 9 minutes from me. And she came back to the crib and she heard the baby screaming and she knocking on the door, ringing the doorbell, everything. And she had never used her key before. But she knew something was wrong. If it wasn't for mommy, Margie Diaz, I love you, I'd be dead. Because she found me in a pool of blood from her son, raping me and sodomizing me 9 days after that baby.
Mm-hmm.
So when I tell you, I mean, I could tell you stories from on end. And like you said, you start out when you're little. You know, my mother told me every day she wished I was an abortion. Every day I heard that. And then he told me every day I was fat, ugly, stupid. Okay, I got college degrees. I'm fat now? What? Bitch, please. I had a gastric bypass. You now 260 from 140 from being a crackhead, but now you 260 and you doing right. And guess what? I'm 125 and maintaining. So, yeah, we go through a whole lot. Like you said, the physical scars here, but the mental won't. I still, when I walk in the store and I want to buy some clothes, I go to the 1X, 2X, 3X, and 4X. Everybody looking at me like, baby girl, you better go over to the teenage section. They do. They really do. They be laughing at me. I will never forget after my surgery, my brother Sal. Oh, I love my brother Sal in the hood. But, yeah, we went downtown Newark. He was like, go shop, Lise. Like, you is not even your size. I go and buy a 1X jacket, and he looking at me like, what the hell is wrong with you? I'm fat. He said, no, the hell you ain't. And just like my homeboys down here be like, Lisa, you little as hell. You need to gain some weight. You need to eat some. Now, I cook for all my homeboys every day, all day. Lucinda could tell you that. I post menus up on my page that I'm cooking for the night for my homeboys, and they'd be like, what'd you eat? Did I eat? No, because I'm still afraid of being that fat person.
Mm-hmm. But you remember, like, when someone constantly says to you, you're fat, and they, that stuff, like I said earlier, it rings in your ear, even though the abuse, and you're long gone, you're out of the relationship, but it continues to ring in your ear, so you're constantly reminded of it, even though you're not in the relationship.
All day, every day. All day, yeah. Every day. That's all I hear. Like, if I swear to God, no lie, I can eat. When I have sober Sundays, look, y'all just going to know something. But when I have sober Sundays and do the domestic violence show, all I do is eat through the whole show. And Like when Bam was here, because Bam is one of my rappers that I represent from Illinois. He's down here now, and Lil Beto be here with me every night. And he was like, Lil Beto was like, TT, you got a whole pizza, and you're going to eat a half a slice. And I looked at him, I said, well, what's the problem? He said, please eat, because you're not fat. But I still think I'm fat. I still think I'm ugly. I still think I'm not worth nothing, like you said. You just carry those for so long. And I don't know. I still have nightmares about the beatings. Mm-hmm. Like Bam, Little Beetle, he will come in and he will be like, TT, wake up. He's not hurting you no more. He can hear me scream sometimes. And it's been 10 years. Mm-hmm. And this is why I stay by myself. I be with my homeboys. I stay celibate. If I'm getting some, it's called a jump off. Because best believe I can't have no looks. She laughs. Look, I'm not trying to do your laundry, not trying to cook for you. Oh, you can come and eat, but best believe you're going to eat something and eat something else, and then just be out. I'm not having nobody under me. I pay my own bills. I got my nails done. I stay fresh to death.
Let me just say this to you as I hear you talk. You have to look in that mirror and tell yourself that you're beautiful, and you have to know that and believe it. And sister, it takes time. You have to continue to encourage yourself and tell yourself, silence those voices that you hear. You know, I don't know spiritually where you're at, but just really, if you meditate, really learn to silence those voices that you hear when you're constantly reminded of him. And rebuild yourself by being around good positive energy and around good positive people that will uplift you and keep you inspired. Because I know what you're experiencing and feeling, but you have to start speaking things into existence and say, I am beautiful. And if I am, you know, full figured, so be it, because I'm a full-figure woman and love every inch of me, every stretch mark, every cellulite, every thigh, all of that. I love all of me, and I no longer hear that guy tell me I'm fat. Okay, well, everybody ain't meant to be skinny. You know what I'm saying? Some people are meant to be full-figure, and love that about you, whatever it is. Love how you were created, because only you were created beautiful the way you are, unique the way you are, and you have to start telling yourself that and eat and be healthy in the process of that. Don't starve yourself because of those voices that remind you of the abuse. Silence that and tell yourself you are beautiful and you are an overcomer.
I do, because now I sit in the house, so I don't care if I have makeup on, and Bam and Lil Beto and all my homeboys will come over, and they'll be like, Lise, what you cooking? Nothing. They're like, I know you got something on the stove. Yeah, I do. They was like, you ain't got no makeup on. Do I need it? They said, no, you really don't, Lisa. But when it comes to me telling myself I'm beautiful, I'm starting to learn. Like, I'll come out the bedroom, I'll get showered and get fresh every day. I'll come out the room, Bam will come around the corner to make his famous potatoes and cheese. Oh, Lord, please. And feed me. And he'll walk in and he'll be like, yo, you always going out fly as hell. Fly as hell what? He said, your clothes, you got clothes for months, Lisa. He said, you come out fresh every day, nails done, makeup done. He said, you really, really have to respect what you're doing. And I go to bars, I get hit on. I'm like, ugh, ilk. But it's just, I don't know. Like, I guess, and you got to deal with my sister Shawnee and my sister Shalana. Shawnee a minister. So, you know, when me and Shawnee and Shalana get on the phone, oh, Lord, it's a two-hour Lisa Hear God session, and I love God. Don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But they start praying, and they be like, bitch, we going to pray for you. I said, did you just say, bitch, and you going to go in the ministry thing? Yeah, because we can get that before we go there. You know what? Go ahead.
Mm.
But yeah.
Yeah. I just say stay encouraged. I don't know what you look like, because those things are not important, or how many clothes you have, or how often you get your nails done, because those things don't make us. What makes us is the beauty that is within. And so that's what I want to say to you, just in talking to you over the phone, that I say to you, a sister, you're beautiful. So stay encouraged, stay empowered, and continue to motivate people through your story, because as we share our story, there's power in our words and there's power in our story to heal and help other people.
Well, you need to be on my show every Sunday when I do the domestic violence show.
Okay, hit me up. I'm on Facebook.
Every Sunday, Monica.
Definitely.
We can connect. Tell everybody that Monica has her own organization now. It's called Stand Up and Speak Out, and it's a community organization dedicated to promoting awareness and prevention by supporting victims of domestic violence and sexual abuse. And they specialize in working with children and teens and those that have even been witnessed or victims of domestic, sexual, or child abuse. So let me go ahead and let Monica tell everyone a little bit about
that. Monica, let me tell you something. When you're doing that too, I am also a domestic violence advocate down here in Atlanta, Georgia, with Brooks J. Young, and we have the Touching Heart Foundation, and I do a lot with them. That's a 200-bed shelter for domestic violence victims.
Okay. Well, I'll definitely look you up, sister, and we'll connect.
Okay, that's what's up. Go ahead and speak now. I'm going to shut up.
She is funny. Stand Up Speak Out started in 2004. Originally, it started as a outreach program to work with women who had experienced, you know, abuse and trauma. After doing a lot of research and getting out there in the community, I realized here in my city that there was not a lot of organizations that focus on working with the teens. So these women went to the shelters. A lot of times they go to the shelter, who they have with them. They have their children. But there's not a lot of support for the children other than support groups and counseling and things like that. Because art, therapy, poetry, writing, journaling, things like that has been a big part of my life. And because I was abused as a teen, over the years in working with women, I realized that the area needed a organization that focused on working with the teens. Teens experience a lot when they are in the home and they witness mom and dad fighting, and also when they have been abused. It shows up in school. You know, a lot of times teachers are quick to say, oh, that kid has ADHD because they can't focus. Have you figured out why he can't focus, or have you figured out why she can't focus? What's going on at home? Right. Have they been abused? You know, and that's one thing that I realized, that a lot of kids that are, you know, being diagnosed with certain, you know, ADHD and things like that, it's something that they're dealing with. So because I did a lot of research and study, and I worked with a great group of people, I realized that the need was not for me to build another organization to work with women, because we have a lot of those throughout, you know, the nation. I needed to focus on working with the teens, because that's when I experienced a lot of my abuse. It did trickle into my adult life, but a lot of it, you know, happened when I was a teen. And I wanted to utilize the method of art therapy, you know, writing and things like that, because that's what helped me. So Stand Up Speak Out is a outreach program that works with teens who've been abused. And been in traumatic, been in the home where there's abuse. And our hope is to be able to help kids learn to express themselves through creativity and to heal. A lot of kids, like myself, did not know how to express myself. So what does our expression come out as when we're teens? Anger, fighting, suspension, getting in trouble with the law. That's how it comes out. And so our mission is to really work with kids and help them in a therapeutic way through art to help them deal with that trauma so they learn how to express themselves, how to communicate, and how to deal with the underlying issue of what they really feel.
if they've been abused, they've seen abuse, how they feel about mama having to go through that, how they feel about watching dad, you know, mom and dad, things like that, helping them to understand that it's not their fault and how to deal with it so that they can be productive as adults and not become abusers themselves.
Right.
Or victims. Because a lot of kids, you know, who have watched and witnessed abuse, they have become adults who are batterers or victims too.
Okay, can I say
just
something?
Because they can't, they take, you know, so much, and then they just want to explode because they're not talking about it and getting it out in the open, and it just stays bottled up inside, and it's like a bomb ready to explode.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So if anyone wants to know more information about Stand Up, Speak Out, and about what I do, my website is my name, MonicaDay.com. There is a page on there, SUSO, S-U-S-O, where you can click on and find out more information about Stand Up, Speak Out. And if anyone purchases anything from my personal site, a portion of the proceeds goes towards Stand Up, Speak Out and our programming.
Okay, now let me say something. The kids are a product of our environment.
Absolutely.
Straight like that. And that's one of the things. I had an author on there. You don't understand who I am. You will find out in a minute. But I had an author on my domestic violence show that went to, he was a victim. The kids are victims, not us. Because we can choose to get out. The kids can't. But he was a product of his environment. They went to shelters and everything else. And, wow. When I got him on my show on that Sunday, and he is actually a male.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was he started talking about how he saw his mother getting violated. So he went on to violate his women.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got locked up.
Mm-hmm.
And then he comes out and he writes a book. He wrote a book that was the woman was a perpetrator, not the man. He flipped the script on everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard that, I was like, what? You got to be on my show. So I had him on my show. And they was blown away because they was like, wait a minute. Yeah. Because it's not always the females. It is sometimes the females that are being the abusers. And that's what people got to understand.
Well,
I totally agree. I totally agree.
Yeah, because they get their neck snapping. They get wild with it. They start cussing everybody out. The kids seeing this. The kids don't need to be in that game. If you want to stay in that game, you stay in it. Get the kids out. There's grandma, there's grandpa, there's family. And if not, they know they can send them to my house. Shit. I got them nieces and nephews to last you for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But I just be like.
Right. And let me tell you, Lisa, we had a guest on our show last year as well, and you can go back and listen to the show sometime. But this girl has been abused all her life as well, sexually, physically, verbally, you know, from different family members. And she was the victim until she got old enough to start having, I mean, adult relationships. Then she had all this anger. She became the abuser. She got into a relationship with a good man who wasn't an abuser, wasn't, you know, he took it for years and years and years. I mean, and she was just, I guess, expressing that anger on him of what she had held in all these years. And then one day after several years, he had enough and he struck back. So definitely. You know, but why are there abusers, either men or women? What did they go through as children? What did they see? Of course, you know, you grow up and you do what you learn. You're watching your parents, your grandparents, your aunts and uncles, you know, and you definitely are, you know, a product of your environment. But what else did you go through that we haven't seen, that you haven't told?
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many kids with secrets out there. I mean, nowadays people are talking a lot more than they did when we were kids, but there's so many things out there that are hurting kids that, you know, families just, you know, don't talk about, they overlook, they pretend it didn't happen. You know, if it's not said, you know, it's not heard, it never happened, just kind of try to forget it or, you know. But that's what's hurting these kids today. I mean, it hurt us. We're learning. We're coping. We're trying to get through it all. And we're trying to reach out and help the kids now. But what can we do to help these kids to be able to talk about their situations, their, you know, whatever situation, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, physical abuse. I mean, you know, you hear kids getting bullied all the time, and then finally one freaks out and flips back, and then he's called the abuser. But what did he take up to that point?
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, I mean, there's just so many issues dealing with that. Right. Exactly.
With the kids, they're scared. They are scared.
Right.
They can't,
well, they're,
you know,
they're coerced.
What goes on in the house stays in the house. That's what it is, and they get scared, and they go into school with bruises and welt marks and all this, and then the guidance counselor calling them in, and they telling the guidance counselor, you know, I fell, whatever, just like we all do, because they're scared. They don't realize that they can talk to somebody, and I've got actual kids that called me on my cell phone. They texted me, can I talk to you now? Yeah, you can talk to me now. Call me at this number. They want to get out of where they are. They are sick of seeing their parents getting abused. The kids don't want to see that. And now they're starting to step up and, like, Lisa, what do we do? Okay, where you at? I got you.
Right.
And they know,
yeah,
they know to call my phone.
There's a lot of kids that are raising their parents. They're watching their parents. They're heroin addicts. They're cocaine addicts. They're alcoholics. You know,
mm-hmm.
kids are growing up raising themselves. You know, or having to go out and steal for food or eat in a, you know, out of a garbage can or whatever they can do. You know, I mean, it's terrible, but it's happening. It happens all the time, and people don't talk about that, but it's
Lucinda,
happening.
Lucinda, their kids, the parents are crackheads on the block, heroin addicts, like you said, and then they get their food stamps and sell them all, or they buy the food. They get all this type of food and go selling on the blocks, $900 steaks, like big-ass meat, like selling them for $5 so they can get a rock, and your kid don't got no food in the house. And then they get the welfare money, and they get their nails done to look cute to go hoe out on the block, but your kids are looking like Raggedy Ann and Andy.
Right.
Going to school looking stupid.
Definitely.
With no school money, no lunch money, no nothing.
Definitely.
But it makes me sick. It makes me sick. And like I said, I was married to a crackhead, and I will never forget the time that my child came in and she said, Mommy, ain't nothing but bagel bites in the freezer. Well, eat them. She said, you going to get your ass beat tonight? And I just looked at her. But best believe, now you can't come in my crib and look at my freezer, my refrigerator, deep freezer, all that, cabinets and all that. They stocked. I don't even play that. And I think that's paranoia from what I went through. And, you know, I got to do what I do. My homeboys eat, my hood eat. Everybody and anybody does eat. I'll make sure of that. But it hurts me. It hurts me to look back at that man that was abusing me. I will never forget. He spent the last $5 on a rock, and we had no food in the house. Nothing.
Right. Now, and then, so, you know, and that goes back to how does that help your self-esteem or any child, you know, at that age, knowing that, you know, they're hungry. And they have to go eat out of a garbage can or steal for food. You know, that makes a child angry. That makes a child maybe abusive or aggressive or,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're just trying to survive. It's not their fault. But yet, in the end, somehow down the road, you know, they get hooked up with the wrong people. You know, maybe they get abused, you know, out on the street. They get pimped out. They get, you know, medicated and sexually abused, or, you know, and those are the kids that we have to help. We have to reach out and say that there's hope for you, you know, just like with what Monica went through. You know what, let's hang on here for just a second. We have Yolanda on the line as well, and I want to give her the opportunity to talk to Monica or ask a question here. Yolanda? Are you there, Yolanda?
Can you hear me?
Hi. How are you tonight?
Hi, how are you?
We're good. Having a good show.
Yeah, it's really good. I was listening to Monica and Lisa, and I wanted to ask Monica, have you gotten to the place where, or have you ever heard of radical forgiveness?
Radical forgiveness?
Uh-huh.
No.
Okay. Well, I'm not making a suggestion to tell you what to do, but that's what came to my mind when you were speaking about that, you know, about the counseling and what you've done, how writing is so freeing, because I'm a writer myself.
Uh-huh.
I paint.
Uh-huh.
I do art, and, you know, and when you were talking about abuse, whether it's physical, I grew up in a home until I was, what, 13, 14. My dad was an alcoholic, and my mother, I tell you, the best thing you can do for a child is to be the best example you can be, even if you take pushes here and there. I told
mm-hmm.
this story last week that when my mother stood up to my dad, he was a big muscle bodybuilder, and he pushed her around, and I guess God and her spoke to her and said, you better not let your daughter think that it's okay for a man to push her around. And she knocked
mm-hmm.
him backwards. And, you know, it's so funny, either one of them remember it. And they said, how do you remember everything? And I just said, well, and, you know, and I don't, and I never held that against them. And I, you know, I did a lot of releasing and forgiving on it. And even now, I'm at the point where, you know, just everything you go through in life, whether it's a little
mm-hmm.
or a lot, or people talking down to you, even on the job, you see people that have been abused and,
mm-hmm.
and in a way, and then they come to their job and they become abusers.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you get to a place that forgiveness is one of the most wonderful things I've experienced, when someone suggested it to me. So they said, well, you know, if you have an alcoholic father, then you have the tendency to create codependent relationships. But
mm-hmm.
the gift for me is in the awareness of it. See, like, you're very aware of, you know, when something is going on, or you're very aware of how you're feeling, is getting in touch with that. And I think that's one of the most powerful things you can share with the girls that you meet when you talk to them in groups. And by being that example to your daughter, we say, yeah, we took enough, but you can get up and walk away. Because
mm-hmm.
there's no perfect world. There's no right. There's not a quick pill. When you really get to loving life and having your relationship, I mean, your relationship to the God that you know, that
mm-hmm.
life is so good that you will see that everything that's happened to you, and whether you put a cap on it, good or bad, and I'm just speaking from my point of view. I'm not telling anybody how to feel. That it was just, it was already worked out, you know, that God is so wonderful. It's just when we turn to half full instead of half empty, then, you know, there's no turning back from that. And when you were speaking, I just thought about radical forgiveness. The person who actually did, his name is Colin Tipping. If you ever look him up, he did a book about it. And I had met so many people, I guess, you know, through my church, that had, I guess, had what you can consider an extreme situation, whatever it was, whether they were abusing alcohol or drugs themselves, or was it a family situation, that just talked about how some of the things that they went through in that workshop were just instant. And I got his book years ago, and I hadn't looked at it in a while. I kept it for a reason. But every once in a while when I find myself stuck, I just open up through a page where he has an exercise in that. And I think what a lot of E said us, and even when Lisa was speaking about when she looks at herself in the mirror, is that somehow we don't still let ourselves off the hook sometimes. When
mm-hmm.
we see ourselves, like I'm a single person and I love it. And I told my dad before he passed away, and he would all, you know, apologize for things that happened in the past. I said, you know, Dad, I wouldn't trade you for any other dad in the world. You know why?
Mm-hmm.
I said, because you kept a whole lot of fools on the other side of my door. I said, I live alone. I said, and I'm so happy. I said, it looks like an overgrown 5-year-old lives here, and I enjoy my space. I enjoy myself. So, you know, it is a process, and there's no quick fix, and whatever road you're on, I mean, it's the right road, because you have the right message for whoever is there. Your message, whatever you say, It's for somebody's healing, and that's the most perfect thing right there, just to be on your journey. And, you know, and to let yourself off the hook and give yourself permission to whatever, you know. And I listened to Lisa talking about she still sees a fat girl. And let me tell you, I'm a big girl. Girl, I'm like 2-3 of you, Lisa. And let me tell you, and when I took karate, when I was in 2 years of karate, even my karate teacher now says, you know, you got to move your feet, move your feet. But I was a lot quicker than people that half my size. Still am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you're just, and we're not supposed to be the same size. That's what's so wonderful about it. We're not supposed to be the same size anyway. You know, so give yourself permission to be, and somehow, you know, we all have to get to that place where we to let ourselves off the hook, like, so what? You know, and I told my dad, I said, you know, Dad, here I am. You know, I was in my 40s, still am. I said, you know, if I hadn't gotten over whatever by this time, shame on me. I said, please quit beating yourself up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you were the perfect dad. You're the perfect dad in the sense that the lessons that I took from what was going on in the house helped me be a better adult. Because by me being independent and single, see, when my grandparents started getting ill, my grandfather would be in his 90s, my grandmother her late 80s. They didn't have any siblings left. Well, they had younger ones, but anybody that could help them with their business, I ended up taking their business, my grandfather's business, then my dad. We just sold their house. So, see, everything happened just like it was supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's nothing, you know, that when you look at, there's no real mistake. And you know, I'm looking at the half full instead of the half empty. And before my dad passed, I let him know that, and I let him know that every chance I got, even when we weren't, you know, even when things would come up, I just let him say, please don't apologize to me anymore. I said, if you think you owe me anything, I said, make the best of your life. I said, that's what you can do for me. I said, you owe me absolutely nothing. You know, and then you have to get to that place too, and we all do. I'm saying we, not just you personal. To let ourselves off the hook, you know, that we are perfect just where we are, wherever we are.
Right.
And I learned from a lady, Cheryl Richardson. She says one thing she says to herself every day when she goes out to speak to people about this, and then she's a life coach. She said she made this mantra for herself. She said, "I love myself even if I suck." You know, she's made so many blunders and this, but you find out the blunders, all those are just stepping stones, you know, when you choose to see it that way. So I hope, and it sounds like you're on the right path, especially with your confidence and knowing who you are. I'm like, this is work for me, and I don't want to hear psychologists tell me how I feel or hear some pills because you feel like this. I'm going to write it the way I write. I'm going to write. I'm going to speak. I'm going to let people see. Here I am, the person that had all this. But, you know, you're the perfect person to deliver that message. You know?
Thank you.
You're just perfect for that. And, Lisa, you are too for what you do. And, Lucinda, for what you do. I mean, I have just been enjoying this so much and just getting such validation that, you know, God is so real. When you see God in everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had this thing when I used to volunteer in the nursery. We had this little sign up for all of us. We walk in, the first thing you see was a sign that says, "There is not a spot where God is not."
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's when you don't look for the God in everything. But you know, but that's our path. That's, you know, but that's what's so wonderful about God too. We have the right to choose. You know, so I'm just enjoying that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Yolanda. Yeah, I think, too, that, you know, when we can get to the point where we love ourselves, then everything, you know, falls into place, and you know, we're not afraid to do anything or, you know, try to achieve anything because we love ourselves and we're just feeling good about, you know, whatever we do, whatever we say, whatever we think. And and Lisa, you are not what you eat. You are what you think.
Exactly.
So, speak positive things and good things and look in the mirror and do positive self-talk, self-imagery or whatever. But definitely, I mean, we've got to, you know, lift each other up and help each other, you know, survive and overcome and be strong And then as we become strong, we're able to, you know, reach out and help the youth. We can't do it if we're not, you know, strong enough to do so. So I mean, we have to continually build ourselves up and each other up and have that trust and faith and belief and hope and and then go out and do what you can do.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
nobody
Monica, what's that, Lisa?
No, this was Yolanda. I just said that nobody can beat you being you. That's what's so wonderful. That they could have a whole competition, but you would still win if there was a competition for being you.
Monica, did you pick out a poem or anything to read tonight?
I did, but I can.
Okay, I'll give you a couple of minutes. I'll give you a couple of minutes to find one if you have one that you want to read. And Boyd is back on the show, so I want to welcome him back. And I know he didn't hear the first part of the show, but are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely here. You know, I'm back in the full effect.
He's back.
Hey,
so,
boy.
Welcome back.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
You know, Lisa had something to tell you, and Yolanda might have something to tell you. And
yeah, I was saying, hey, boy,
right,
nice to see you. Nice to hear you, rather.
Okay,
yeah.
No doubt. You know, it's always good to, you know, see how people are on top of things and tuning in on Wednesday night. Like I said, you know, I hate I was late, but the miss has been howling at business, and, you know, I've been spending time with my family members who I have never even met, you know, so that was it has been an amazing and hilarious day. Trust me.
Yeah.
Hey, Rob, it's Lisa. What you doing, baby?
What happened?
I said, hey, Rob, it's Lisa. What's good, baby?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, today was my father's funeral, you know, and I had a chance to meet some of my brothers and sisters who I've never even met in my whole life. So it was a real exciting moment today, you know.
I know. But I want to give you congratulations and lots of hugs because we knew what you was going through, especially us family. We knew what you was going through. And we had your back.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Oh, I appreciate that. You know what I mean? Actually, two of my sisters I ain't never met in my life. You know what I mean? So I had a chance to meet two of them today. And one of them is the same age I am. You know what I mean? One of them is 30 years old. That's my baby sister out of 12 kids. They're my father's 12 kids. And I had a chance to meet one of my brothers that's 50 years old, you know, and ironic that me and him was running in the same neighborhood for years, and he never even knew I was his brother. I never even knew he was my brother, but his cousins is my homeboys. So today was we were just talking about old things, and he was like, oh, man, you know, people used to talk about you in the days, man, this, that, and other, but I ain't know you was my brother, you know, whoop-de-whoop. I'm like, as good as we probably did hang out back then, you know. He said, yeah, everybody knows you, bro. Everybody knows you. I said, yeah, so he gets on the phone and calls Detroit, and, oh, man, all the lines open up. They say, oh, man, Rob, your brother, oh, man, da-da-da-da. So one thing, you know, kept leading to another. And then his daughter, it's ironic, his daughter, mama's brother, got a daughter by my mother's sister. Oh, man, we was going down memory lane tonight, man. I was like, blew back, like, wow, you know what I mean? That Detroit East Side, believe me, boy, you know, you never know who your people is. You know?
It might be down in the dirty South, you know what? Let me just
say. Yeah, you know. Yeah, so it was an exciting moment tonight, and like I said, I had five other brothers that I never even met that wasn't there on the scene, but, you know, my pop went away, and he went away good knowing that, you know, it was all forgiveness in the house, and he went on and, you know, went on with the Creator. You know, it was his time, it was his moment, but, you know, definitely going to keep his memory alive and his legacy alive, you know?
And it took his passing to bring his kids together, and you know, and that's a blessing, because I know, you know, all of you are going to carry on great things, and just to have that family is awesome, you know. And I hear a happiness in your voice all day today, and I know it's because you're with your family.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it's just amazing because, like I say, nobody is no bum or none of that. You know what I mean? I mean, it's just amazing. Everybody is intelligent. Everybody is professional people. And, you know, we're sitting there talking. And my one brother was like, I do that. I'm like, oh, I do that. You know what I mean? My sister was like, I do that. I'm like, oh, man. They was like, we all got talents from pop, you know?
Wow.
it was a real, real, real reality check. You feel me? Today. And it was just amazing. I didn't know how I would feel meeting my brothers and sisters, you know.
But it was
all good, you know what I mean? And like I said, it's amazing.
Right.
You know, and I'm just here that.
And one thing I've always told
right
Rob, because you've known he's had all his. What's that?
I see it just tripped me out that I had a brother that was running in the same neighborhood I was running into. He wasn't in the lifestyle I was in, you know what I mean? He was a sheltered guy, but I knew his cousin in them, you know, and that just opened it up, what he called his people, and said, man, you will never guess who my brother is, Lil Rob. They was like, you
well,
man,
it probably
they,
surprised they, you that you had an older brother because you had no idea. You thought you were the oldest.
Right. Period. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I got
right
two older brothers older than me, 153 and 150.
Wow.
Uh-huh. So
amazing. Amazing.
And, he's a locksmith, and he's an engineer, you know?
Wow.
Uh-huh. Right. And then my other brother, he's a graphic artist and a designer, and, you know, run his own thing, you know?
Uh-huh.
And my sister is the manager, you know, over the Salvation Army and giving back and helping people. She's the manager over there that gives back and help out. And, you know, my baby sister, she has her own ministry for 10 years, and she's only 30 years old, raised in the church, no kids, you know what I mean? You know, don't know nothing about this out here, you know? So that just blew me away, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And she was amazed who her brother was, me.
Right. You know, let me just throw something out here since you mentioned the Salvation Army, because that is one of the companies that will work with ex-felons, help train them for job positions and different things. So
they went to the website last night.
The Salvation Army.
They went to the website last night and they was all blew away. You know what I mean? They started telling me about my wife before I even got to mention her. You know, they said, "Oh yeah, your wife is manager and da 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 da." You know? So yeah, we went to your website, bro. And I'm like, yeah, that's all good then. You know, so you see what Bud doing. You know, I'm off in a whole nother realm than what we're talking about now. You know, that was my old lifestyle. You know, and. It was just an overwhelming moment to see, you know, five faces looking like me.
That's awesome.
My father definitely had some strong genes because every one of us looked alike.
Well, you looked just so much like your dad. You know, there's like one picture of him I remember standing by at the library that I had to look and say, is that Rob or his dad? Because it was when he was younger, about your age. I was like, wow.
I just want to let everybody know too that we will be putting up a lot of information about my father, you know, which I received a lot of information from my sister that she gave me today, things that my father been had tucked away for many, many years, and that's, you know, you would figure it'll be tore up or messed up, but it's all in definitely great order, you know, brochures and different kind of literature about him and his life, you know, and pictures of him through his whole life. Everything he touched, he put his picture on. So people will be able to see a lot of things of my father on the in memory page that my missus put together. And I will be selling his books again. I will be re-releasing his books, which he has 66 books around the world. And we will start releasing some of them books, you know, and they all speaking on life, you know, and speaking on things to better your life as an individual and better your mind as a person. And his books is all about conditioning yourself to do better and greater in life. So we definitely will be doing that, and we'll be putting up mass pictures of him with some of everybody, you know what I mean? When I say everybody, I'm talking about everybody that was somebody and people that was trying to be somebody. So, their memory page is going to be a boy memorabilia history all the way down the lane, you know? So get ready, people.
Well, it's just amazing to think, though, that your dad was friends with Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, and, I mean, they really had a big political friend party, you know, and your dad is a reverend. I mean, just the circles that he hung in were with great people, with amazing people.
Yeah, Bob Hope and everything. And, you know, I have a few books that I did get from my sister, one of my father's books called Rare Gifts, and another one of his books is Pardon Me, May I Have Your Autograph, and the Mind, you know what I mean? So I have a lot of different things on the flow for people now. So it ain't just the Streets Don't Love You Back movement now. You know, my father's dream and his legacy will definitely stay alive through me and my wife and through my other siblings as well, you know, because it is what it is, and our father was not just any man, you know. He was great as a Martin Luther King and great as a Bob Hope and great as any president ever been in the presidency, you know. So that Robert D. Boyce Sr. name stands up. Believe that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to give a shout-out to Pops and just want to say go ahead and rest in peace, Pops, because Junior is up to bat now, you know. So the game is on like Matty Strong.
I hope he's on like Strong. Got a couple of teams there. Let's go ahead and go back to Monica. Did you find a poem?
Yeah. In light of what, you know, we've talked about and tonight, domestic violence and working with teens and things like that, I have this poem. It's called Dispatch 911. And it's also a workshop that Stand Up Speak Out does as well. And so I'm going to just get into it.
Okay.
Too distant to be mentioned. Ripped into family secrets never to be broken. Hoping no after effects will affect her senses, but it did. After 26 years. Hidden tears find their way to the surface. See, she had lost her courage because someone hurt her. Lapse of memory had her taking risk. Lapse of memory had her mind playing tricks, but no, she was starting to remember. The hit. The first time his penis touched the rim of her lips and he told her to kiss it, she clenched. At the taste of leftover urine that made her feel like she would vomit. Droplets of premature ejaculation made her hate him. Conversations between God and the devil made her lose her salvation. Devastated that someone who claimed to love her would make her a victim. Close kin. More like cousins, sneaked in while family members sat at the dinner tables reminiscing on the good old days, while children played in back rooms. They say the little ones are so innocent, so they drop their overprotectiveness, had older siblings and cousins watch over them while they pretend to be grown up, but someone was a little too grown up in the game of house. Shh, don't be too loud. Don't ever let the secret come out, and it didn't. Held it in, never to bring it up again. Buried it and swept it in the crease of an abandoned room, never to be resumed. But soon visions will show vivid pictures of little children who would never fully bloom. Confused because their souls have been devoured, and now another innocent child's soul have been devoured. Cause mama's not paying attention. Too busy listening to the latest gossip coming from the church pulpit that she missed her daughter's cry for her attention. She didn't even know that her child's soul was missing, wishing that mama would come to her rescue. But that child's 911 phone calls never got through. Lines disconnected. We're sorry. The number you call cannot be completed this time. Please check the number and dial your call again.
And again she calls, but no one seems to recall the thousands of calls for help, the rebellious behavior, the suicidal attempts, the running away from home, the skipping school, the unable to pay attention in school, the multiple sex partners. Did anyone bother to take the time to calculate the signs? No, they just brushed it off, said this was just a phase that would soon fade away, so they took olive cooking oil, anointed her head, and prayed. But soon after that, they lost their faith, took her to unfamiliar counselors who thought that they could make her break the silence. But she was too far gone now. She was violent, juvenile delinquent, all because her guardian angel, a.k.a. her mother, didn't pay attention. She just didn't believe that someone snatched her precious seed, took her to the fourth floor on the elevator, and robbed her of her virginity while she was in the same vicinity, speaking in tongues, giving God the glory. But no one wants me to remember this story, and no one really wants me to tell this testimony, but I have to, because as you sit and listen to this poem, every second that goes by, a child is being abused, a son is left confused, a daughter is left internally bruised, and a mother is refusing the truth. This could be you. Your child might be screaming right now for you to come to her rescue. Don't disregard it. Don't disconnect it. Don't press ignore on your cell phones, because your child might be screaming for your help because she's afraid and alone. So answer that 911 phone call and dispatch yourself to your son's or daughter's location, because your voice and your presence might just be their savior. Thank you.
Oh, wow. That is amazing. That was beautiful and well done and well said. And wow. That's all I can say is wow.
Yeah, that's definitely a doorway, you know?
Definitely.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was right on
point.
And
definitely from the heart.
Yeah, we definitely helped the fans and the listeners out there. Definitely took that into perspective, because you couldn't have said it no better than you said it. You know what I mean? So great job.
Thank you.
Right. We only have a 2 or 3 minutes left here, Monica.
Okay.
Just what could you, you know, tell somebody out here that's listening, a teenager or, you know, anybody in general, you know, what advice could you give them about, you know, if they've been raped or if they've been in a situation like that and they're lost?
Right. My advice to anyone that's listening, whether it is a teen, whether it is a woman who was abused as a teen, or a male who has struggled and watched abuse or been abused himself, my advice is to seek help from someone. Find someone that you can talk to. If you've never shared it with anyone, if you're holding on to the secret and holding it in, it's only going to sit there and continue to fuel and fuel and fuel, and you're never going to reach your higher self in healing. So my encouragement would be to find someone that you can confide in, that you can talk to. There are a lot of support groups. There are a lot of agencies that are out that you can call in anonymously, and to try to find someone you can talk to, and to get involved with probably a support group. If you don't want to do counseling or you're too afraid to go to a support group, they have hotlines that you can call to talk to someone. But I would encourage you to try and reach out to anyone that will listen to you. If you are a child, sometimes children go to people, and, you know, I know a lot of children who go to parents who they don't listen. They don't believe them. You know, if you go to someone and they don't believe you, tell someone else. And tell someone until someone believes you that can get you to the right resource. I don't encourage you to hold it in, because if you do, it continues to be a vicious cycle. As a teen or when you become a grown-up, it becomes a vicious cycle that never ends. And so you continue to hold on to it, and it trickles into healthy relationships that you transform from victim to an abuser. So seek help. Look online. You can also go to my website. I have several people that have come to me seeking advice, and I will refer you. I will get you to the people you need to get to. Sometimes it just takes talking. Other times you may need their therapy and counseling. But talk to someone who will listen to you. And if you're in an abusive relationship and you're listening to this radio show tonight, the abuse doesn't end. If that abuser does not get the help that they need, the abuse will continue. And it's more important for you to leave so that you have your life than to stay and be another statistic.
Right. And Monica's website is Monica Daye. It's MonicaDaye.com. And
I am also on Facebook and Twitter and all those different social medias.
You have to join our website, The Streets Don't Love You Back.
That's right.
And
thank you so much. Thank you
You're
so
welcome.
Much for
thank
having
you so
me
much.
On the show. I definitely appreciate it. Much love and respect to The Streets Don't Love You Back. Keep on doing what you guys are doing because it's an awesome movement.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing
your story and your testimony. It was very powerful, and you know, hopefully it can touch somebody else out there and help them change their life.
Absolutely.
I just want to let everybody know next week our guest is Renia Rubaker, also known as Holy Land. She's a female here in Arizona. She grew up out on the streets as a young teenager. She was like thrown out on the streets as a young teenager, lived on the streets, had to fight for herself to, do anything. So she kind of dressed like a boy, acted like a boy, became like a boy, was a boxer. She did box some fights, and she's going to tell her story next Wednesday night of how she was able to survive the street life and everything that she went through. And we also have a boxing match set up for her here in Phoenix at the Copper Gloves here when the state fair comes around in October. So we're going to hear her story. I think it'll be pretty powerful as well. We'd just like to thank Yolanda and Lisa for joining us again tonight. And Rob, we just want to, you know, once again, glad you're back with us, and rest in peace, Dad. And any last words? We're out of time. Rob?
All right. I just want to say thank you, everybody, for their prayers and love and concern. And don't forget to join our movement and also stop by and learn a little bit more about my father and son. The comment page that we have for him on in memory page. And we just want you to just keep learning about great history and keep learning about how to deal and stay away from domestic violence and how to speak out about it and how to nip that in the bud before it gets started. So we definitely want everybody to just stay tuned in and stay connected up, and let's keep making a difference and changing people's lives. So that's the bottom line, what I have to say, and God bless.
Thank you. And remember, The Streets Don't Love You Back, and join us next Wednesday night and every Wednesday night live. And we're going to go out with a song, Lay My Feelings Down. Everybody have a great week, and we will join you back next Wednesday night.
All right. Appreciate everything.
My eyes, I can read your mind. Let my fingertips pop it down your spine and lay your feelings down. Giving me the sign to cross the line. You already mine, so it ain't no crime. Let her eyes do the talking, girl, and know that I'm gonna lay my feelings down. Ain't in no hurry, gonna take my time. Look into my eyes, I can read your mind. Let my fingertips pop it down your spine and lay your feelings down. Giving me the sign to cross the line. You already mine, so it ain't no crime. Let her eyes do the talking, girl, and know that I'm gonna lay my feelings down. When I first saw you, couldn't believe my eyes. From the first contact, you had me hypnotized like rolling tides in paradise. Gotta put in some time, gotta make you mine. If you got a minute, could you spend it with me? If you gotta go, just know one thing. I think about you every time that you leave, and I miss you for your goal, so won't you stay, please? You are what I need, baby.
Your body's like a taste of my own space.
Can I touch you, please, lady?
Explore your frame in every single place.
Gonna take my time when this goes down.
We got a little secret nobody gotta know.
Let's have good conversation, lay our feelings down.
If you feel the same, then let me know.
Ain't in no hurry, gonna take my time. Look into my eyes, I can read your mind. Let my fingertips fall down your spine and lay your feelings down. Giving me the sign to cross the line. You already mine, so it ain't no crime. Let her eyes do the talking, girl, and know that I'm gonna lay my feelings down.
plan on giving you everything you need. Let me undress you and plant my seed to show you all the things that you won't believe. I need your full attention, not to mention concern. Now that we sin, just listen and learn. I'll spend my addiction and offend to earn my wish for your kiss to quench this burn. You are what I need, baby. Can I touch you, please, lady?
Explore your frame in every secret place.
Gonna take my time when this goes down.
We got a little secret nobody got to know.
Let's have good conversation, lay our feelings down.
If you feel the same, then let me know.
Ain't in no hurry, gonna take my time. Look into my eyes, I can read your mind. Let my fingertips fall down your spine and lay your feelings down. Giving me the sign to cross the line. Already learned, so it ain't no crime. And I hide through the talking, girl, I know that I'm gonna lay my feelings down. Ain't in no hurry, gonna take my time. Look into my eyes, I can read your mind. Let my fingertips follow down your spine and lay your feelings down. Giving me the sign to cross the line. You already learned, so it ain't no